take a twist. But you still have the freedom to travel.
Get out, see the world, because you can.
Hello everyone, this is Cindy Smith with the Freedom to Travel live internet radio program, coming to you with a new schedule of every other week now on Sundays at 6:55 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 3:55 Pacific. You might want to give us a call and speak with my guest, so take this time to grab a pencil and paper and jot down all of our call-in numbers. And remember, too, if you're not catching it now, you can go to the BBS Radio website, and it's on there as well. So let me just quickly give you those numbers. If you're anywhere in the world besides Canada and the United States and you'd like to contact us, you can call direct at 530-876-3222. If you're calling from Canada or the United States, you can dial 888-815-9756. Anyone in the United States can also call 877-876-5227. So I am the executive producer and host of a television series called The Freedom to Travel Show. And if you haven't had a chance to listen to my first show, then briefly I'll explain. It's a series where I take a guest that's disabled to a travel destination that's totally accessible. So in each show, I highlight my guests, their achievement, their attitudes around their disabilities, and I also educate my viewers on what that disability entails, and we get to go have a really good time together. This radio program is an extension of it in that we are traveling, but not in the literal sense. Instead, we're traveling deep into our hearts. We're enhancing our love, our connection, our understanding of one another. We're going to be taking a journey into a heightened awareness. This is a new perspective or an outlook on issues of disabilities, a sort of voyage deep into your soul, taking you to a newly enlightened dimension of yourself. Before I introduce my beautiful guest, Daniel Gilliatt, I want to take this opportunity to thank Yale University School of Divinity for inviting me to speak at their conference last night for the Society for the Anthropology of Consciousness and the American Anthropological Association. I felt absolutely honored to share my near-death experience with such a diverse group of highly educated and knowledgeable professionals. It was a great evening. And tonight's also going to be a great evening for me and you, my listeners, because my guest, Daniel Gilliatt, he'll without doubt entertain you with his life story, his experiences, and also give you some insight as to how he has overcome diversity and change, especially in a physical way, through his deep understanding and passionate spiritual beliefs and practices. So very briefly, Daniel's a 36-year-old single parent of four children, and was at war in Iraq as a Marine when he lost his leg. And somebody caught wind of his story. I think we'll hear a little bit about it. And he ended up being the lucky recipient of a new home and a new beginning, really, of which you're going to hear more about, that was televised and produced by Extreme Makeovers. You may have seen him and his family on the show, and if so, you're going to know that we're talking about an extremely honorable and courageous man. He's given so much of himself to our country and his fellow comrades, and I couldn't think of a more worthy person to receive this amazing gift of love from so many people. So with great honor and respect, I'd like to introduce you to Daniel Gilliatt. Happy Easter, Daniel.
Happy Easter.
There he is. We made it. Yay, I was a little worried about the phone.
Me too.
I'm doing I'm doing good, Daniel. I just want to sort of let you tell our listeners your story about your childhood and maybe touch on some of the things that you may feel have helped you become such a strong man today.
I fully believe that I was kind of molded into the person that I am due to a pretty rough childhood coming up, being really poor and at time living without lights and water and going through a divorce when I was 8 years old and not having anything and always having to wonder about what next meal consisted of or if you were even going to get a next meal. Not having a father figure around and dropping out of school because there was no structure or discipline, and at the age of 18 realizing that that was the worst thing I could possibly do. So at the age of 17 I'd started doing martial arts, and by the time I was 18 I'd realized that I needed more discipline and I needed my education. So that started my journey into completely turning my life around 180 degrees. At that time, I went to school in Montana to an all-Indian job corps to start my education.
Wow.
And at that time, it was a mental, physical, and spiritual heightened awareness. Once I got into the Rocky Mountains up to this job corps and lived amongst the Native American Indians, I gained many a friends and learned a lot about my Native American heritage, and went to sweat lodges and just became involved with everything I possibly could. The sweat lodges was very spiritual. It was like their way of doing church and being closer to God. And I was part of the running team, and I was involved in all the sports and all the activities, and got my education, a 4-year trade in heavy equipment diesel mechanics. And shortly after that, after I got out, I decided I needed more discipline, so I joined the United States Marine Corps.
You decided you needed more discipline. What made you feel like you needed a little more discipline, Daniel?
From where I came from, constantly running away from any challenge when I was younger. When school got too hard, I ran away from it. When everything got too hard, I always ran away. Instead of taking my problems head on, I ran away from them. Once I started taking martial arts and started learning that challenge was a good thing and I could conquer anything if I really faced it head on and gave it everything I had, go ahead.
Which I think is really amazing, because one of the things I want to express to our listeners, and which I'll have a second to tell them about, is how you handled the loss of your leg. So carry on. You were saying,
carry on.
The last thing you were saying is, yeah, go ahead.
So I felt like I needed more discipline, and it always amazed me that when you face something head on, and you gave it 100% of your heart and soul, no matter how hard it got, or if maybe you failed the first time, if you got right back in there and you got right back into it, it was amazing what the human being could absolutely go beyond anything that you think it can possibly go beyond. That was one of the gifts that I received in boot camp. Was there was times when you were climbing mountains and you had drill instructors hollering and screaming at you, and you just got so irritated because it was like they were trying to get you to quit or trying to get you to fail so that they could work even harder. And just out of sheer determination, you figured, you know, you'd die trying. If that's what it took, you would just not give them the satisfaction of quitting. You'd look back 20 or 30 miles later and say, man, I should have been dead way back there. How did I physically and mentally get beyond what I thought was impossible? But you did. They always push you beyond anything you thought was possible. And so that really got me thinking. And also the other thing was they said, go ahead, quit. You know, when you quit, it's so much easier to quit after that. You know, quitting becomes an easy thing. So don't ever quit. So those were two amazing pieces of life that I really got out of boot camp was never quit, because quitting becomes so easy. And, you know, failure is not an option. You know, give it 110% even if it freaking kills you. And that pushes you beyond anything that you think is humanly possible. The mind and the spirit is just an incredible thing.
Well, you know, I really appreciate the way you just explained that, because nobody has ever so well put to me what the experience of boot camp is truly like. And I can understand how you must have gained so much respect for yourself.
It truly is. It's blood, sweat, and tears. They so push you so far beyond anger and everything else. When you think that you're going to fall over dead, something kicks in and says, do not fail. You know, do this until it kills you if that's what happens, but do not fail. Do not give them the satisfaction of quitting. Quitting is not an option. And you force yourself, you force yourself, you force yourself, and you do what you want to do. You do what they want you to do, or whatever that goal is that you're reaching for. And when you get there, you stand at the top of that mountain and you look down at the bottom and say, man, I should have been dead back there. Or how did I make this? How was that possible? I have no clue, but because I was so determined, I pushed myself beyond anything I ever thought physically, mentally, and spiritually that I could handle. And just because I took it one step at a time, I made it. And it's the same thing.
Great.
It's the same thing with the loss of my leg. You know, there's days where I get so
consumed. Wait a minute. I have to interrupt you there. I want to take it from there, but we have to go from being in boot camp to what you actually did during, you know, what your job was, what you did, and how did you lose your leg. And then you can really give us the oomph of how you know, this determination took you through it.
Okay. So anyhow, back to boot camp, you know, there were certain things that were molding me along the way, and I went in when I was 23, so I was older and wiser than most of the guys, so that really helped me out in a lot of ways, and I was able to step back and look at some of the valuable things that they were teaching us. So I got into the Marine Corps. I loved everything about it. There were so many different things that I was so intrigued with, you know, everything from physical fitness, running and everything, to guys that were into bodybuilding, guys that were into martial arts, guys that were into shooting guns at the rifle range, everything that you could possibly be into, there was somebody that was also into the same thing. It wasn't sitting in front of the TV playing video games. It was getting up off of your backside and going out and enjoying life and living it to the fullest, experiencing things, going deep sea diving and everything else. So every day was a molding experience within the Marine Corps, because there was somebody there that wanted to experience the same thing that you did. I was a mechanic for the first 4 years. 2 years into it, when I was in Okinawa, Japan, I got into heavy equipment machine guns, heavy machine guns, and I became an expert with those. And so throughout part of that career, I also taught everything about heavy machine guns. And once I got out of the Marine Corps and I had a wife and a couple of kids, I couldn't stay away from the Marine Corps, but I didn't want to go full-time and neglect my family either, so I went into the reserves. In the reserves, I hooked up with a group of Marines who needed mechanics and somebody who knew how to run the heavy machine guns. So I fell into the perfect category for what we call the grunts, the ground pounders of the Marine Corps. And they were just the most amazing group of guys that I've served with. And I did my first 4 years with them. Couldn't get enough of it, so I had to do another 4 years. And I was in the process of joining another 4 years when we went to Iraq this last term when I got hurt.
Mm. So you were in the reserves, and you had two kids, you were married. What made you decide to go ahead and go back to enlisting, in the war?
After September 11th. There was a lot of Americans who were afraid to go outside. There was a lot of people who had gone into their homes and locked their doors and was afraid to go outside. And I did not want to grow up or have my kids grow up in a place where they have to be afraid to go outside. I wanted them to know that somebody close to them was going to go and fight for their freedom and let them know that this is not tolerated and somebody close to them will defend this country. You know, just like hundreds of thousands of people before us have. You can't come over here and, you know, do what they did on September 11th and get away with it.
Mm-hmm.
So when the first tour in 2003 came around, I was asked to go to Iraq, and I did. And at that time, you know, I wasn't too involved with the Iraqi people other than helping a lot of people get food and water that didn't have, and seeing the change in the country from people that were hunted like animals to people who are now free and starting to experience what freedom was all about. And at that time, I had the opportunity to visit a lot of wonderful places like Babylon and cross the Euphrates and the Tigris River, which you read about in the Bible. So it was a very biblical and historical, you know,
very interesting. And you know what else is interesting? I was thinking about today being Easter and what a spiritual man you are and how much strength you have. And I've learned so much, you know, over our conversations and have so much admiration for you. And that today would be, you know, Jesus's day, really. You know, I thought, wow, isn't this all just so much energy around? Yeah, always has for us. So you decided to go back. You went back in, and while you were there, were you still working with heavy machine guns?
When I went to Iraq the first time, I was still working with heavy machine guns. Plus, I was still working being a mechanic. Plus, we were tasked with running convoys, which is escorting heavy fuel and heavy trucks up into Iraq to support those who were actually fighting in the war. So that's pretty much what it was, is us running convoys the first time around. The second time around, which was started January of 2005, we actually ended up in Iraq in March of 2005, and July 3rd, 2005 is when I got hurt.
Want to tell us about that?
Yes.
So July 3rd.
Well, from the start, it was around July when we found out that we were definitely going back to Iraq. July of 2004, we found out we were going back to Iraq. And as we worked up to go to Iraq and we were training to go to war, I had this feeling that something bad was going to happen. Not so much that I foreseen or was expecting something bad to happen. I just felt it deep that something was going to happen that was going to completely change my life, that I was either going to be killed or have a near-death experience, and I was going to have to accept it and just relax and breathe through it. So we did our workup. I had the opportunity to not have to go back to Iraq that second time. And me and my wife at the time were having problems. And I had asked her, you know, what she wanted, because I had been trying to make our relationship work. She didn't act like she was too interested, so I asked her what she wanted, because I didn't have to go back to Iraq, and she stated that she felt we needed time apart, which meant she didn't know whether she wanted to stay married or not. So I told her I would go back to Iraq for her, that the money would be good, and she could stop going to school and do what she could start, she could go back to school and stop working. Mm-hmm. And the first 3 months I was there, I never even received a letter. So it was a very hard and very trying time for me. Here I am, thousands of miles away from home, and I have this gut instinct that tells me that something really bad is going to happen. No letters or anything, you know, for at least 3 months. When I was able to call home, my wife at the time was very cold and very distant from me. It was almost like talking to my mom on the phone. You know, there wasn't no emotion there, or the emotion that I was looking for anyways. And so on July 3rd, Again, I had this feeling, and I really thought it was going to be a bullet wound, and that I was just going to have to breathe through it and not get excited, not bleed to death. And as it was, we hit an anti-tank mine, something that was supposed to blow up a tank, ripped the whole front of our up-armored Humvee apart, and took my leg. I was very aware of this. I was very conscious. I was very coherent. My ears were ringing. Once we hit this road, this anti-tank mine that was buried in the dirt, my ears were ringing. The vehicle was no longer vibrating. I looked down. My pant leg was shredded, so I knew my leg was bad, but I didn't know how bad. I opened up my door and fell out on the ground, and at that time I hollered for somebody to help drag me away from the vehicle because my right leg was pinned. I couldn't pull myself away from the vehicle. But at the same time, I was worried about my guys because a lot of time there's a secondary bomb. When everybody runs up to help you, they detonate everybody and kill quite a few people. So I was more worried about the guys than I was myself, but I also wanted away from the vehicle. So I hollered at somebody to help get my other leg untangled, and they got up there, got my right leg unstuck, and then I watched my buddy remove my foot from the truck separately. So I knew my leg was gone. I knew how severe my leg was damaged by this point, and I also knew that if I got excited, I was going to bleed to death or I was going to go into shock where I wouldn't have any control.
Mm-hmm. So, now, is that something you learned through martial arts, or was that something they teach you in the Marines?
I think it, that's kind of funny that you asked that question. I think it was something I learned in the Marine Corps on being tough for my guys, because I looked around and some of my guys looked really stressed out, and I knew I had to be strong for them. I learned mind over matter through martial arts, being mentally tough and ignoring the pain, putting your mind somewhere else. So that was part of the buildup. I was teaching martial arts at the time I got hurt. So I was teaching Tai Chi and Qigong and some other Kung Fu and some other karate and whatnot. So I was kind of mentally prepared because I had done some meditation and stuff prior to this point because, like I said, I felt like I was going to get wounded over there. Mm-hmm. And so mentally, you know, for like 6 months, I prepared for that in particular point in time. And then there was this voice in the back of my head, and it was my mom. When we were growing up, we were always getting hurt, cut, stitches, broken bones, and she was always the calm one to say, oh, it's not that bad, you know, calm down, you're not going to bleed to death, you know, slow your heart rate down, it's not that bad. So that was one of the things that was going through my head. When my leg was missing, I knew that there were some major arteries that had been damaged, and we were a long way from a hospital. And I knew if I panicked, if I allowed the pain to get to me and I freaked out, I knew if I went into shock, I wouldn't have survived it. So I laid there for about a half hour. And during that half hour, like I said, I started looking around at my Marines. I was okay with it. I started looking around at my Marines, though, and they kind of looked stressed out. So I started making jokes about it. And one of the in particular jokes was is we'd been going to the gym, so that in particular day was leg day. We were supposed to go do curls and squats. So I looked at my captain and I said, sir, I don't think I'm going to make the gym tonight. And everybody laughed. And so I just started making jokes because it really helped them accept what was going on. And that half hour later, when the helicopter got there, they got me out of there, and it was like another half hour to the hospital. Now, they said that I died twice on the helicopter ride because I'd lost so much blood. I think I was so determined not to die that I really don't remember seeing any bright lights or anything like that. But they said I shouldn't have made it, that I lost so much blood and that I did die twice on the helicopter ride. And later on when I've talked to my guys, they said it was a strength that they just couldn't believe. They said, you know, it was just beyond them to see somebody laying there with their leg missing and making jokes about it.
And one of the things that you and I had talked about previously in one of our conversations, and I found so fascinating, that that you mentioned how much blood loss there was actually on the ground.
I've got pictures of that, and it actually looks like somebody had just had a bloody nose.
Wow.
There was hardly any blood on the ground whatsoever.
Wow, that's amazing.
I mean, yes, there was a tourniquet, but for having your leg completely missing, no more than just what looked like a bloody nose on the ground, it was pretty impressive.
Yeah, no kidding. You lost, I know your foot was detached from your body, but whereabout on your leg did you actually receive, as a result you lost your leg, but where did they, how far up or where exactly is the end?
Well, initially it was below the knee, but by the time they got through cutting all the bone and muscle back to keep the infection out, it ended up being above my knee.
Oh, I see.
So I lost my leg above the knee.
And do you remember much pain?
I remember a lot of pain. I was okay. Very clear. I was very coherent. I knew at that particular time that it was my time, and I'd either survive it or not. And I was bound and determined not that I wasn't going to die. Now I had my wife and kids to look forward to. My kids is what kept me alive on the battlefield that day.
Wow. So they came to mind, but you said that you didn't have a lot of fear.
No, I didn't have a lot of fear. I had a lot of determination. There was something in the back of my mind that kept telling me, I am not going to die a couple thousand miles away from home. I am going to survive this. I will see my kids again.
Mm-hmm. So then you got to a hospital. And what happened from there, Daniel?
I got to a hospital, and for the next couple of days, for about 2.5 days, I was in Baghdad, and I was kept being told that the airplanes couldn't come in to get me because of the sandstorms and the rockets and the mortars. So I had to lay in a hospital bed and listen to more rockets and mortars coming in and blowing people up. So I was still uncertain of my survival at that time. And one day they finally got me out of there, and when we landed in Germany, I smelt the smell of rain and fresh air and grass and green trees, which is completely the opposite of hell where I was.
Yeah, yeah.
And so when I landed in what felt like heaven, I completely relaxed, and I don't remember anything after that for about the next 3 weeks.
Right.
But I was told that through friends and family members and even doctors that as soon as they allowed me to get into a wheelchair, I was gone. I was off visiting the other soldiers and sailors and Marines because they were all Americans to me. I was off visiting them, see how their mind and their spirit was holding up. I was off talking to them. How are you guys doing? You know, what was your injuries? What did this consist of? What did that consist of? How are you doing?
Passing around the love, huh?
Absolutely. So with me losing my leg, I really felt it was a blessing because I had something in common with these guys who were also going through this, and I wanted to make sure that they were okay and they had somebody to relate to. It's different for somebody that's got all their limbs and who hasn't been to combat to say, oh, it's going to be all right, you're going to do fine.
Right.
It's different for somebody that's actually been there, has actually gone through this and done something with their lives instead of taking a turn for the worst.
Yeah. So then here you are in the hospital, you're helping all these people, and there came a time when it was time to go home. Tell me about that.
The first 27 days of my injury, I was looking at a lot of guys who had lost limbs and weren't taking it too well, and I also seen some other guys that were getting up and moving on with their lives, and so I wanted to be determined and be like those, because I knew that within this, you could go one of two ways. You could completely take a turn for worse and get into drugs and alcohol and just call it quits. Or you could get up and you could fight through it and have determination. And like I said earlier, you know, failure is not an option. So within 27 days of me losing my leg, I was walking.
Wow, and that's within, miraculous.
And within the next 2 months, I completely blew away everything they thought was physically possible. If they told me I couldn't climb stairs, I was climbing stairs. If they told me I couldn't ski with two legs, snow skiing because of the prosthetic leg, I went skiing with two legs.
Wow.
And
that blows my mind.
The first time I got on skis, I spent an entire day doing it with a prosthetic leg just to say that it could be done. And then I spent the next two days learning how to do it on one leg, and within those 2 days we were doing black diamonds. And I'd never skied before in my life.
My goodness.
So we're doing black diamonds.
So that boot camp really helped out, right?
Absolutely. It really did, and so did the martial arts, and so did just, you know, just being stubborn and determined and doing what I want to do.
Yeah. Well, speaking on behalf of many of the Americans in this country, I am so thankful to your strength and courage, and I really appreciate, I just want to say how much I adore, as well as the rest of the American public, everything you've done for us as a country, and, you know, you're an amazing man. So one of the other things that you had mentioned to me is that while you were in Iraq, you had the one and only professional tattoo parlor.
Yes. Now, the first time I went to Iraq, I tried to keep it fairly quiet at the time because it was totally frowned upon, and I did it completely professional. You know, everything was sterile, everything was clean, but it was also an opportunity for somebody to get a tattoo in Kuwait or Iraq and get it at a really good price. I wasn't trying to rip nobody off. And because I'd gone through all the channels that I'd gone through and went through all the medical profession and all the higher ranking people that I did, I ended up getting it authorized, which was completely unusual. Being that I had all the documents and documentations and the legal rules and laws of how to tattoo and what's accepted and not accepted on your body, when I went to Iraq the second time, the higher ranking officers and the first sergeants and the majors who knew about this right from the very beginning decided that this was going to happen, and they had me write up the entire way I was going to do the tattoos according to the rules and the regulations of the UCMJ, which is the Uniform Code of Military Justice. And we were able to actually have a professional tattoo parlor and hand out flyers and pin up flyers on base, and even the Army would hold formations to let their guys know that there was a tattoo parlor on base and that they could go get tattoos. Everything had been checked out by the higher-ups and by the medical profession to state that it was all professional and at really good prices. So within 3.5 months, I made about $8,000.
Now, oh, my Lord.
That sounds like a lot of money, but if I was charging the prices that I would have been charging back here in the United States like most people, it would have been more like $20,000.
Wow. So how many people do you think you tattooed in the process?
Hundreds. And the whole thing about it, was, if you're going to have a memorial tattoo of a fallen brother who was killed on the battlefield, if you want a memorial tattoo, what better place and honor than right there on the battlefield? Mm-hmm. You know, when you come back from a mission, you know, hey, such and such got killed today, I would like a tattoo in his honor. And, you know, typically it was a tattoo of the M16 turned upside down in a set of boots with the dog tags and the Kevlar helmet.
Mm.
It's a little memorial that
the
military sometimes does, or they do, for fallen brothers when they're out on the battlefield. And
So you not only tattooed Americans, in one of our conversations you told me how all of the different types of people that you actually worked on. Hello? Daniel? Hello? I think I've lost you. Hello, everybody. Sorry about that little mix-up. We had some confusion here, but we're back. We've got Daniel, and I was so entranced I forgot to take a break, but Daniel, you were talking about all the I said you weren't just tattooing Americans. Is that correct?
What's that? I missed your question, please.
You weren't just tattooing Americans.
Oh, no. I was tattooing anybody who wanted a tattoo. I was tattooing Royal British Marines, Royal British Army, Army, Navy, Air Force, you name it, anybody and everybody. We even had an Iraqi translator who was working with us to help talk to the Iraqi people for cooperation on finding bombs and bad guys, and also help distributing food and water to those who needed it. So a couple of Iraqis as well.
Wow, what an experience, Daniel, huh?
Truly what an
experience. There was another lady, I believe it was a nurse in the hospital that worked with you when you lost your leg, that referred you on to ABC, is that correct?
Yes, she was one of the ladies, Julie. She was my first nurse when I was in Baghdad. Totally an amazing woman who just really inspired me. I don't know, there's something beyond what I can explain. Just an amazing woman that seen something amazing in me and was just right there by my side the whole time. And so
I'm sure, yeah, she saw how amazing you are, and she went on ahead and referred you to Extreme Makeover.
Yes, she was one of the people who referred me to ABC Extreme Home Makeover, plus there was two or three other women who also referred me to the ABC Extreme Home Makeover. So it all came together at the like perfect timing, at the perfect crossroad. They all, without knowing each other, all
I have to laugh.
About the same time.
I'm laughing, Daniel, because you said, and a few other women, because I saw, I got in touch with Daniel because I saw the Extreme Makeover, and I was so overwhelmed by it. I mean, Extreme Makeover is a great program anyways, but your show, you just touched me so much with the service you've done for our country, you know, the whole military involvement, and then this amazing house they made for you. But, you know, it's no surprise to me, you said, and a few other women, one of the things I noticed about you, Daniel, is how gorgeous you are.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So it's no surprise that many women were referring you. So I got a hold of you, and I wanted the people to hear your story. And also, can you tell us a little bit about what it was like with Extreme Makeover?
Well, let me build up to this. This is the crazy thing. A small act of kindness has just, you know, snowballed into something so massive. It's same thing like small acts of ignorance or stupidity or hate or anger. You can see how crazy and evil and corrupt the world has become. When I was in the hospital, I did little acts of kindness for the guys who I felt needed it. You know, guys that needed somebody to talk to give a motivational foot, you know, or kick in the pants when they needed it. So my whole thing was to talk to the families, educate the guys who were wounded, and try and make their lives different, try and motivate them, try and, you know, whatever it took to make their lives easier, and to motivate them. So this whole thing started off, I didn't expect a pat on the back or any type of recognition. I did this out of the kindness of my heart, and for them to accept this and grow from it and then give it on to somebody else who needs it. So I come home, you know, and then I get another devastating blow where I go through this divorce that was completely unexpected after only being remarried to the same woman that I'd been with for 10 years. I remarried her, and 3 months later, after spending $13,000 and buying her a big old diamond ring, she decided she wanted a divorce after I'd only been out of the hospital for a week because my entire recovery time with paperwork and everything else took over a year.
Oh,
or right out of a year. So I get out of the hospital, and exactly a year to the day, on July 3rd, the same day I lost my leg, I got another devastating blow. My wife asked for a divorce. So again, I could have called it quits. I could have sunk to the bottom of a bottle and everything else. And I thought, you know, here's another challenge that God has requested of me, you know, and I can either fail or I can get up and fight through this. Mm-hmm. And somebody had told me, God only gives you what he thinks you can handle. So when you hear so many different people go through a divorce and they just completely go the opposite direction, I was like, okay, here's a time to fight through. So I stopped smoking cigarettes. I enrolled in massage therapy school, and, you know, and again, the massage therapy was to help me learn how to breathe and relax and learn how to enjoy life and accept and give something that makes people feel good.
Mm.
And so, and it was also a build-up because I want to do chiropractic eventually. I like helping people. So over a period of time, I'm working. The school itself didn't work out because I was so back on bills that I didn't know about. When I was in Iraq, my ex-wife had gotten a lot of credit card bills and stuff that I was unaware of. So long story short, I had to stop school because I was in a great amount of debt that I was unaware of. They started taking money directly out of my bank account and forced me to stop going to school. So
and
then
well,
I started getting
and raised children.
Yeah, trying to raise children, so then I immediately had to try and find a job, and, you know, and the next thing you know, I'm struggling, but again, you know, stopped smoking cigarettes, didn't take up drinking, and just kept fighting through, and next thing you know, here's ABC, you know, wanting to redo my house. So I got to looking at all the, you know, I'm sitting out in California when ABC kicked me out of my house, I'm sitting in California, and all these people from all over the United States started calling me and saying, you know, it couldn't happen to a nicer guy. You deserve it. You know, you were there for me. You were there for my family. You were, you know, just hundreds and hundreds of people's lives who I'd touched that I didn't even realize I'd touched. It was just one person, and it was one small act of kindness, and it was never asking for a thank you or nothing. Here's all these people from all over the United States, and I guess this even went up as far as President Bush. Here's all these people calling me, congratulating me, and thanking me. And I'm like, wow, you know, I still can't believe all of this. So then next thing you know, I come home on the day that they give me my house, and there's over 12,000 people here hollering for me and my family. Over 12,000 people. And I was told a couple days before we were coming home that so many people, when they step out of that limousine, that they completely are blown away by all the energy and all the energy coming off the crowd, that they kind of freak out. And when Ty comes up and says something to them, they automatically turn their backs to the crowd, and they look at the bus, and then they're hollering, move that bus, and they miss that moment. So I got to thinking, how can I absorb that moment? How can I absorb all that energy and all that wonderful love and stuff that's coming from the crowd? So as soon as I got out of the limousine, and I'm kind of disappointed that they cut some of this stuff out, but when I got out of the limousine, I looked at every single face in the crowd, and then I hollered, ooh-rah, which is a Marine Corps term, and I had 12,000 people holler it back.
Right on.
So I got to stand there and play with the crowd for a while, which, you know, I played with them for like 10 minutes before Ty actually came up and said anything to me. Then I was just so absorbed by the energy, and I was so blown away by you know, how many people showed up here to pour their heart and soul into what is now my house.
Which is absolutely gorgeous.
Which is unbelievable. And any time anybody ever comes by here, I show them my house. And the first thing I do is I walk them into the front room, and I flip on some real soft music, and I turn on the fireplace, and I have them stand here. I have them stand here, and I have them close their eyes, and I have them take a deep breath, and I tell them to completely let all the stress out of their body, and just how amazing this house feels and how well the energy just floats through here.
Nice. Very nice. Well, I've said this from the beginning. I'll say it again. Couldn't have happened to a more worthy recipient. I'm telling you, I was very touched by your show. I'm very touched by your story and so many of these details that we haven't been able to get to, because I could just sit here and listen to everything you're saying and how many people's lives you've touched. And you know, you're thinking all along, you're just little acts of kindness improving people's lives. It's a big deal. So one of the things I wanted to ask you too, and we only have like 5 minutes, but
I know. And one of the things I really wanted to add was not only was there 12,000 people here, but we actually reached over 47 million viewers, and it was rated even higher than the Grammys.
Oh my Lord!
I've reached over 47 million people, and I've had just floods of letters coming in, which I've tried to respond to everybody's letters, emails, and phone calls. And so far I've been pretty successful, and it's just amazing the stories that keep coming in on how I've changed people's lives and people that haven't even met me. And I think that this is only the beginning. I truly feel like I can conquer the world at one person and one small act of kindness at a time.
Earlier in our conversation, I said, what do you see for your future? And you said you were going to change lives. I said, what do you mean? What do you mean? And you explained, and maybe you'd like to tell our listeners what you said.
What I have in store for my future is I want to conquer the world. I want to change people's lives. I want to reinvent the human spirit. In a world where everybody is out to basically cut each other's throat and stab each other in the back, I want to completely open my heart and soul and change people mentally, physically, and spiritually. Give them hope, give them drive, just completely reinvent the human spirit. I mean, you know,
I can honestly tell you, when not too many people do that in the world. So watching the Extreme Makeover show it was just absolutely touching. And I actually, I have no doubt that you are going to have a large, large input with changing and redeveloping the human spirit. And
well,
I love everything.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I truly believe that I was blessed by God. I've been received a gift. And the best thing that I can tell you and all the viewers out there, anybody that's listening to me right now, that I truly live every single day as if it was my last day. I'm thankful for every minute of every hour of every day, every breath that I get. And for anybody who's out there, imagine if there wasn't a tomorrow, if you had one day to live, what would you change differently today? So that you live with no regrets. If you love somebody, tell somebody that you love them. You know, be careful on how you tell them and to what degree that you love them, but tell them you love them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, live a life without regrets. Have no fears. Live life to the fullest.
Mm-hmm.
You only
Beautiful.
Get one chance.
Yeah, Daniel. Amazing man. I can't thank you enough for being on my show, and I'm sure we'll have you back on in the future because you've just inspired so many people, I'm sure of it. Your story is beautiful. You're a very strong and courageous man, and you have so much to offer so many people. So thank you so much for taking the time out of your Easter Sunday to spend it with us and tell us what a beautiful man you really are.
Thank you for being inspired and having me in this position where I can reach more people.
Yes, absolutely.
So thank you.
Thank you, Daniel. So just very quickly as a reminder, keeping things very simple, what you need as far as information to the radio show, my future guests, my television show can all be found on my site at www.freedomtotravelshow.com. There's some information on Daniel Gilliatt as well. And if you girls want to get a hold of him, or guys, of course, I'm kidding, you can always go to my site and I can put you in contact with Daniel. So thanks to all my listeners and my beautiful guest, Daniel. Blessings to all of you for listening and supporting me the way you have. And remember to get out and see the world because you can. There's a whole world waiting for you. What are you waiting for?
Cause and love.